Blog Talk Radio.
Your Partner in Success Radio is a free business podcast with host Denise Griffiths. It's all about great stories, conversation, and context to help you move your business and life forward with actionable tips and advice from her guest experts. To listen and subscribe, just find us on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you consume your podcasts.
Welcome to Your Partner in Success Radio. I'm your host, Denise Griffiths, and today I welcome to the show a really fun duo. Jennifer Rock and Michael Voss are here to share stories with actionable tips and advice to move your business dreams and your career forward. Now, Jennifer Rock and Michael Voss spent 2 decades careening, I love this word, careening through corporate America and barely lived to write about it. As company journalists, speechwriters, and C-suite advisors, they stockpiled insider stories and cautionary tales in their newest book, Operation Clusterpuck. Don't you love that title? In their words, following your dream is just too passive. You have to pursue the hell out of it. And they are here with me today to share stories and actionable tips that will help you move your career forward. Good morning, Jennifer and Michael, and welcome to Your Partner in Success Radio.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
It's really great to be here. Thank you.
Look, I have been looking forward to this. I love the title, as you can tell. When your PR people approached me about this, I went, just send me the book. I've got to read this book. So I'm really looking forward to this. So before we go a little bit too deep into it, tell people a bit about yourself and your background, and then we'll go right into the things that you're here to share, which are fascinating. So let's rock it.
Sure. So both Mike and myself, we have, as you said, been in corporate jobs for about 25 years. So, you know, between the two of us, we had about 45 years of experience working in some big jobs at big companies. We've been professional communicators our entire careers. So that is working with the top of the house at corporations on communication strategy. So we were really privy to a lot of things that go on behind the scenes at big companies, the decisions that are made at, you know, board of director meetings. And you know, our job was to keep some of those stories out of the headlines and the hallways. So on the side, we both took very, very good notes. And at some point, we put those notes together and said, I think we have enough for a novel, which actually turned into 2 books. The first was BS Incorporated. The second is Operation Clusterpuck. That's the sequel. And along the way, we quit our jobs and started a communication agency. And that's the way we got to where we are today.
I have to ask, how did you come up with that title? I mean, I think I kind of know, but when I read the message, I have to be honest with you, I spit coffee on the cat. I thought that was the funniest title that I had ever read. Cat didn't like it. I liked it.
So I have to give full credit to Jennifer, my writing partner. She came up with the title. We had been writing the book with a working title that was far less interesting and far less edgy. And our publisher at Wise Inc. Really encouraged us to push the envelope a little bit and come up with something a bit more edgy. And it's a bit of an inside joke for the characters in the book. The story is that the company is expanding into Canada through a project called Operation Wanderlust. But the people working on it, of course, just see how much of a cluster it actually is and how many things are going wrong. So they, behind the executives' backs, they call it Operation Clusterpuck.
Now I'm giggling again. It's like grade school humor. Like, oh, you said a bad word. It's just... It catches you. It catches you at a level that you don't really expect, doesn't it? Okay. Can you guys hear me?
We can.
Okay. Where did I leave off? Anyway, I think we're having a bit of a little bit of a time delay. What I was saying was that the title just cracks me up. I mean, it really, really does. I don't know if you heard that or not, if I had muted, but it's kind of like when you're in grade school and somebody says a dirty word and you just kind of snicker behind your hand. Every time I look at this book, I get a goofy smile on my face. It's a great story. So before we go too far down the rabbit hole, let's talk about some of your talking points in the book, because I know you've got some great stories to share, you know, from actual tips, actionable advice. So why don't you tell us how you came up with following your dream is too passive, which I agree with you. I'm not arguing with you a bit. You say follow your dream. Following your dream is too passive. You have to pursue the hell out of it. I know you've got some great stories around that. So do you mind sharing some of those and the actionable tips and advice that kind of go with those stories?
Yeah, happy to. So, you know, for us, this is a very personal story, because writing a book or starting a business are both very time-intensive things. And for the book, it took us 6 years to write that first book, because we were writing and editing on flights, nights, and weekends, and tons of rejections along the way. And you know what? It's difficult to do anything, 35% of the way. And you can't be 100% successful on anything if you're doing it as a side hustle. And especially writing a book is incredibly difficult to, you know, keep a cohesive plot and characters that are interesting when, you know, by the time you pick it up again, you're forgetting where you've even left off writing it. And so for us, we both individually had the dream to write and to publish a book. And that for us, it was the idea that we couldn't just tick away at this, you know, between meetings and our spare time. If we were going to do this, we needed to do this big. And we ended up leaving our corporate jobs. And with the severance and the time that we were given from those jobs, said, we're going to take some time because, you know, if not now, when? We're going to finish this book and we're going to get this published, because we both always wanted to do that. And, I mean, it was a tough decision, but it was also one of the best things we've ever done, because, again, I don't think we would have accomplished it had we not devoted 100% of time to it.
Now, what did your spouses think about this? Because that's a toughie, leaving your job, giving up that income.
Absolutely. And much like everything Jennifer and I do, we have sort of opposite ends of the spectrum on spouse reactions here. For me, I was very fortunate. My wife knew that writing a book was a lifelong dream of mine, and she is a professional. She works in human resources for a large national bank, and she encouraged me. She said, go for it. And she, you know, would continue to bring home the bacon, so to speak, and really supported me behind the scenes. And Jennifer, I know you have a bit of a different take on how that worked for you.
Yeah, I got a divorce.
Ouch.
And of course, you know, we are all in different situations and different things.
Right.
But there are, you know, it was kind of a terrifying time, right? Because not only did I lose an emotional support with my spouse, I also lost a financial safety net. But I had absolute faith and confidence in the business that we had started and the book that we were writing. And you know, I have one tip for your listeners. I would say, you know, make sure that you have your own financial safety net. Make sure that you have savings and that you've squirreled away some money, so that if you find yourself in the position of either quitting your job or getting laid off, that you have something individually to fall back on.
Listen, that's great advice. I did the same thing. I decided, well, my personality decided, because I am a highly committed introvert and I'm a cranky person most of the time, and having me in your office is not a good idea. Trust me. It's just not. If you want your coffee, get Joan damn self. I'm not going to do it for you. So it's just best that I'm off on my own. And I went through a lot of what you're talking about. You know, I had to have, and do to this day, absolute faith that I was walking the path that I was forging and meant to be walking, and wound up getting a divorce later, a little bit later, but it was in the works. So it was just, you know, it's, you do what you have to do, but I love that you say you have to pursue the hell out of your dreams. I agree with you wholeheartedly.
It's as I said, it's very difficult to be completely successful when you're only partially in. You know, you have to decide whether you're all in. And if what you're doing, if your dream is your side hustle, if it's a hobby, that's fantastic. But just be purposeful with that decision. And if, you know, you're going to be all in, you have to be all in. And there's some kind of terrifying thoughts and some consequences that can come from that. But, you know, there's no great time to do this. You just have to jump in sometimes.
Absolutely true. Michael, how about you? Has this been terrifying for you, or is this just such a culmination of the dreams that you've had? I mean, how has it been for you? Because this is scary. My audience, I mean, audience is comprised of solopreneurs, small business owners. They're all over the world. And most of them have the same dreams that we all have. Own our own business, have, you know, the say in how we're going to do business, and really create a lifestyle that we want, knowing full good and well that it is hard, stinking work. If anybody thinks you're going to quit your job and open a business and be successful, sit down and think about that for a while. You're going to work very, very hard. So, Michael, what do you have to say?
I would say, you know, it was certainly terrifying on my end as well. And really, you know, I mentioned that my wife continued to bring home a paycheck. But, you know, we went through some lean times, and we still occasionally, you know, when our business has some slower periods of time, it's a little bit scary. And I want to be one of those people who contributes to my household income. My wife and I have two boys. We're saving for their college education. So when we go through those lean financial times, absolutely, it's difficult. And it puts a lot of stress and a lot of pressure on a person, because you want to be successful. You want to be able to provide the things for your family that you'd always wanted to do. And it's, you know, it takes time, and I'm sure everyone in your audience has gone through or is maybe currently going through some of those lean financial times. And we, Jennifer and I, are really fortunate that we have each other to sort of remind the other person that, you know, we can stick with it. We're successful, we're smart, we work hard, and the business will come and the book sales will come. But absolutely, I don't think you're human if you don't go through some of those struggles and feel them. But it makes the success all that much greater when you come out the other side.
Exactly. My attitude is, if you're not terrified, you're not doing it right. You're doing something wrong, which sounds counterintuitive. So you talk in the book about creating a legacy purpose-driven career. What does that mean exactly?
So, you know, for us, it's very interesting because Jennifer and I took very different approaches to our careers, even as we worked together. And the two protagonists in our book, Will and Anna, are based loosely on me and Jennifer. So for me and for Will, we always just took whatever job the company gave us, whatever assignment we were given, and we never gave a great deal of thought to where our careers would go. And Will has a bit of a crisis of conscience about that in Operation Cluster Puck. And with Jennifer and the character of Anna, they were very, very purposeful on where they wanted their career to go. By this age, I'll hold this title and I'll be making this much money. And I think what we determined is that both of those approaches are somewhat flawed. If you are too rigid, you're not going to enjoy the journey along the way. And if you're too loose with your career legacy and where you want to end up when you're done, you might end up completely on the wrong path. And we've got a couple of tips for your audience on that. For me, again, I tend to go a little bit more on the feeling side of things. So I really questioned when I decided to leave my job at Best Buy headquarters here in Minneapolis. It was the way I felt going to work every day no longer felt good. For 14 years, it did. It was great. I loved it. But once I realized I didn't feel good going to work anymore, I realized I couldn't do it. So for me, I think about it as, you know, as business people, we're so trained on the analytics and the data and what does that tell you. But sometimes you need to stop, as difficult as it is, and ask yourself how you're feeling about your career, how you feel about going to work every day. And that can be one indicator on whether you're in the type of role that's going to help you leave the legacy you want to leave. And Jennifer, I know you have a little bit more of an analytical take on it.
Yeah, I'll add to that. Like Mike said, I've been very career driven and very purposeful already with my career my entire life. And so you know, I had the next stepping stone, the next title, the next promotion always in my head, but, you know, to what expense? There were times when that was at the expense of my interpersonal relationships, or probably at the expense of my marriage, where I over-indexed too much on that career plan. And so some of that creating a legacy and being purposeful is about how you're going to balance your professional and your personal life. And, you know, one of the things I learned, again, from a very analytical perspective for your audience, was through Lean Six Sigma training, if any of you have been through that, where there's a really great method of the five whys. And you ask yourself why to the answer of every question. And originally, you know, you may be thinking kind of on a surface level about something. But if you keep asking yourself why, you eventually get to the root cause. So if you ask yourself, why are you in the job you're in? Well, because it has a great paycheck and I want a promotion. Why do you want a promotion? Well, because I've always been taught that that's the measure of success. Well, why are you working for the company you're working for this promotion? Well, because it makes a good paycheck even though I'm unhappy. Why are you unhappy? You know, eventually you'll get to that question that makes you pause and say, am I balancing my work and my professional life the way I want to, that makes it a happy life for myself? And, you know, this is just our experience. We are not life coaches. We can't tell you what decision to make in your life, but I think our main goal is to just make a decision, you know, be purposeful about how you spend your time and your career and your personal life. And that's really the key to being happy with both.
And see, that was going to lead to my next question. We spend, whether we're a solopreneur as I am or we're working in a corporation or a small business, we spend most of our waking hours in that business physically or thinking about that business or moaning and groaning about the day at that business. I mean, it really is a massive part of what we do and think about every day. So I agree with you. If you are going to be at some level, maybe you're not even really aware of it, but just kind of miserable, veering towards wretched, probably time to do something else and do that soul searching.
I would completely agree. And, you know, my personal story is that, you know, we both worked big jobs at big companies. And it was a kind of a toxic relationship, and I didn't realize it at the time. But I was on call 24/7. I slept with the phone in my hand, knowing that there would probably be a 3 a.m. phone call with some emergency I had to deal with. And I think a lot of people are in that position, and they don't realize the toll it's taking on them until they're out of it. You know, time and distance are great healing properties from a company. And it was 6 months before I stopped sleeping with the phone in my hand. I mean, it was a process to extricate myself from corporate life. And again, being your own owner of a business is not an easy path by any means, but it's a different path. And again, it's a choice.
It is. And one thing about being a solopreneur, entrepreneur, there is a distinction there. So I keep separating those words out. But you have to have a cast iron stomach. And you have to understand that you're going to fail probably multiple times a day. And then you're going to dust your, you know, get up off the ground, dust your butt off, and go back and find another solution, kind of like Einstein did all those thousands of failures. But it's not without its rewards. I mean, I wouldn't do anything different. You cannot hire me to do a job. One, you can't afford me. Number two, you won't like me at the end of the day, so it's just not going to happen. But, you know, I love that you guys are, and Jennifer, look, I totally get it. I mean, you almost had PTSD there. You know, just having to extricate yourself. That's just, I have to tell you, my skin crawled when you were describing that. That's just not right. That is just not right.
I was just going to say, I have to tell you that, you know, I had a really eye-opening moment in my life when I went for my annual doctor's appointment, and they do the, you know, the cholesterol and the blood pressure and the weight and, you know, all the normal things. And my doctor showed me the charts, my charts, over the last, you know, at the time it was probably 2 years after I had left my corporate job versus the following, you know, before like about 10 years into my corporate job. And she said, you probably added 10 healthy years onto your life just in what I was doing, the toll, the late hours, the, you know, eating food out of the vending machine instead of, you know, real dinners at home and that kind of thing. And again, I sometimes think it's like, you know, it's that old adage about the frog that's in a pot of water. And if you turn up the heat slowly, you don't know that it's killing you. And I think a lot of us are in that position and we don't realize it until we can step back and take a long look.
Exactly. Michael, do you have similar stories? This is fascinating because, listen, I'm listening to you and I'm just kind of going, yeah. Been there, done it, maybe not to the degree that you have. Seriously, if somebody calls me at 3 in the morning, somebody better be dead or their house better be on fire. There is no excuse. I'm just not going to take it. So, and either of those can probably wait until tomorrow anyway. So, yeah, it's just, I can't even imagine living like that with your phone in your hand. I mean, there was a movie I saw called, and this reminds me, when you were talking, it reminded me of this movie with, I can't remember her name, I'm not a big movie watcher, but it's called If I Were You, and the woman was sleeping with her phone in her hand because her mother was in a nursing home. That's about the only time I would even consider doing that.
Sure,
and it was
yeah,
never it's... just to watch. You know, it's like, oh, it's a great movie, by the way. Go find it. It's really cute.
Yeah, it's again, it's. I love it when Jennifer tells that story because it really is illustrative of how we sort of lose sight of what's important and we allow our careers to sort of creep into our personal life and take them over. And for me, it was a little different. For me, it was just a lack of patience with my kids and just quick to anger and quick to be judgmental with the kids. And I just wasn't a happy guy around the house. And again, I operate a little bit more on how I'm feeling about something. And I began to understand that it was this pressure and the stress of work and not liking my job. And I was taking that home and too often taking it out on my wife and my kids and didn't like the guy I was becoming. And so that's really what prompted me to make the change.
And that makes sense. I mean, like I said, you are spending almost all of your waking hours at work or thinking about work or bemoaning work or dreading work, whatever, or combination of all. And you do take that home. I mean, you absolutely do. I remember when I was still married and you know, we were working, we both have technical degrees, computer science degrees, and you know, he hated his job. I really hated mine, but I was going to school at night, so I had to work. And man, I would barrel through that door and start complaining. I don't think I even said hello. And I remember one day he looked at me and goes, Mike, in this very plaintive voice, he said, it's my turn. Fine, go ahead, you can complain now. And that was a big eye-opener. That's when I said, I'm done. I cannot do this. This is not my personality. I don't want to be hanging around, like you said, in boardrooms, hallways. Not me. I mean, I don't want to eat out of a vending machine. I didn't want any of it. I had this whole litany of things I did not want, and I was doing every one of them. And I was wretched. And I made sure he was miserable with me. So I totally get what you're talking about.
You know, and I think, you know, Denise, that's one of the things that made us write a novel instead of a nonfiction book. You know, it's probably, you know, a little difficult to listen to somebody's experience and apply it to yourself when you're still deep in that corporate experience or maybe a toxic job or something like that. I think it's a little easier to read a work of fiction and to identify with a character and not, I don't know, there's something I guess that doesn't feel so preachy about it. Like, you know, I have been through this, therefore you should listen to me and here are my, you know, my 10 life coaching tips. Nothing against life coaching, but I think what we really set out to do with our novels and Operation Clusterpuck was to immerse people in a story where, you know, perhaps you can take some lessons out of it, but you're still laughing and you're still enjoying the characters and it's still a page turner. and you're still wondering what's going to happen to these characters. But when you think about it, you think, wow, there are actually some similarities to my life and what it's like to be traveling internationally and the craziness of trying to hold down a job and to just make a paycheck when everything is stacked against you, or at least that's what it feels like. So, you know, wherever you can find your inspiration, wherever you can identify with a story like that and be able to make some good decisions in your own life, I mean, go for it. I think that's great.
I was going to ask you why you wrote it as you did, so you got ahead of me, and thank you for that. So also in the book, you talk about surrounding yourself with smart people, which I think is, that should be at the top of your list every day. You are the people that you surround yourself with. I mean, we all know that. If you're hanging around with five broke people, you're broke too. If you're hanging around five really smart, wealthy people, you tend to take on, you know, their attributes and their characteristics as they do yours. So let's talk a bit about that. And I know you've got some great tips there.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, we have really some examples from writing the book and from starting our own business. And on the book front, what was really eye-opening for us was working with talented editors. And people tend to think of an editor as someone that corrects your grammar, but really they're somebody that immerses themselves in your story and in your writing and with your characters, and they see things in your story and in your characters that even you can't see. And really the very first editor we worked with was eye-opening to us in a scary way. She was going to give us a 3 or 4 page summary of our manuscript, and she gave us 72 pages of edits. And we realized very quickly what we didn't know about writing fiction, about writing a novel, about developing characters, about setting scenes. And we had to look each other in the eye and say, we're going to do this, right? We have to rewrite this entire 355-page manuscript from the beginning all the way through to the end. And we said, yes, let's do it. This is, you know, this is the kind of expertise that we need. We were going around thinking we knew what we were doing, and this is a gift, even though it was a gift that was going to set us back probably 2 years. And then on the business front, you know, we always use the example of we're communications consultants, but of course you have to count the money and you have to track the money. We're not accountants, so we hired an accounting firm so we could focus on doing the work with clients that we believe we're best at doing. And in the same way that an accounting firm might hire a communications firm like us to help tell their story. So we really view it as not only just smart people and people with expertise, but people who bring complementary strengths to the table. There are certain things that each of us is good at, and Jennifer and I certainly complement each other's strengths. We have some overlapping skills and strengths, of course, but neither of us is going to become an accountant, and neither of us knows enough about editing and developing a manuscript that we could do it without the expertise of a really good editor or two or three.
Was there any point where you looked at each other and went, okay, that we didn't see that coming, but we've got to make a living, so let's go do what we do, which is communication? Did that ever cross your mind?
Yeah, of course. I mean, it's, you know, again, we joke, but it's absolutely true. First of all, the whole, like, look at each other and be honest. You know, in terms of surrounding yourself with smart people, I would say, number one, you know, get a sounding board. If you don't have a business partner, somebody that you trust who you can, again, have that moment where you look at each other and say, let's do this, then find somebody who, you know, who can help be that objective sounding board for you, a mentor, a therapist. I would strongly suggest making sure that it's somebody who doesn't love you. And I mean by that an objective third party, you know, somebody who can give you the tough love, an editor who can say, that thing that happens in chapter 9, it should really happen on page 2. Or that accountant who can study the tax laws and say, here's what you should do. Or that business partner who can look at you and say, okay, maybe we should set the book aside for a bit and actually build a business so we can make a paycheck. Again, that's part of that surrounding yourself with the smart people that you can trust and kind of giving yourself over to that person in the moment and say, what do you think I should do here?
And a mastermind sometimes is, I find masterminds very, very helpful. A mastermind can be me and one other person. It could be me and five people. but I depend pretty heavily on them, you know, because they're not emotional about it. They don't have the emotional attachment that I have to whatever part or role I'm playing in the business or the construction of whatever it is that we're building, whether it's a webinar or helping a client write a book or doing social media. They're not attached to it emotionally. And I'll tell you what, every once in a while I get smacked around. And I go outside and look at my trees and go, I say bad words. But I always come back in and go, well, you know what, there's some merit there. Let's let this percolate, let it sit, and come back to it. Don't reject it out of hand. That's tough, but it's a sign of maturity, right? Tell me this, because I keep telling myself, I'm growing up here.
And you know, I just add, you know, in terms of an actionable tip, just be honest about your limitations. And there's no shame in that. Your limitation might be knowledge. Again, I'm not going to go learn all the new tax codes. I'm going to rely on an expert for that. The limitation might be skill, and it might be time. I mean, your time is worth a lot of money. And if you are building your own business, you know, we are, again, communications consultants and telling other company stories and things. We should be spending most of our time doing that. That's our expertise, and that's what we're great at. So, yeah, maybe I could go learn how to do the 47-page tax return for an S corporation, but my time is better spent actually working with clients and working on my core responsibilities of my job. So, you know, that's my number one tip is just be honest about what you know and what you don't know. And then go connect with the people who have that knowledge, who have that skill, who can fill in the gaps for you.
Now, one of the things that I hear from a lot of people, a lot of, you know, people who are maybe new to becoming their own boss, the first thing, and you may hear this as well, the first thing out of their mouth, oh, I can't afford that. You know, I'm going to give myself a headache or knock myself over one day from rolling my eyes so hard. You can afford it. You must afford it. The question is, how do you afford it? So do you get these kinds of, you know, immediate, like, oh, I can't do that. I can't afford it. I've got to do it all myself for right now. How do you help people with that mindset who really think they cannot move forward because the money's not in their bank account at that moment?
Yeah, we certainly have those conversations with each other and probably in our own heads as well. And, you know, of course, when you are a solopreneur or an entrepreneur, money is, you know, it's a finite resource. And you have to be really smart about tracking it. You have to get it. And so we have those conversations and have those trade-offs. But again, I think we view anything like that, like hiring an accounting firm versus doing our own taxes, those types of things. We hire a publicist to promote our books because we don't have the time to be doing it. So we view those things as an investment that frees up our time. As Jennifer said, time is possibly your most valuable resource. So you can use money wisely spent, wisely invested, to free up your maybe more valuable resource, which is your expertise and your time. And you use that to really drive the revenue side of the business and making those, you know, really thoughtful choices about how to spend and how to invest.
That's very smart. So if somebody comes to you and says, look, I just don't have it. I can't find the money anywhere. Do you have any tips for people like that? Because, listen, we're all there at some point. I've been there. You know, sometimes, and I hope I won't be there again anytime soon, but it happens. You have the lean times, you have the good times. But, you know, I've had those talks with myself. It's like, I can't find this money anywhere. I mean, I need it. I know I need to not be doing this particular thing in my business. It's taking too much time, too much energy. It's frustrating the heck out of me. But I just can't find the money anywhere. So do you have any kind of tips or advice for people who just are stuck right there? Do they walk off? Do they get a loan? What do they do?
You know, and that's such a personal decision because, of course, there are small business loans, and if that's a route that you are willing to take, absolutely. I mean, that's an option that's available. And again, you know, being your own boss and having your own business is tough, and there will be dips, there will be ebbs and flows. And there is absolutely no shame in the part-time job. I mean, if you have to step away a bit and build up the coffers with some cash that you can invest in your dream and your business, take a little time and do that. You know, we know a lot of people in our industry who do freelance, or, you know, they do some freelance work. They do some contract work with companies, and they, you know, write articles for magazines for a little side cash and things like that. Again, there's no shame in that. I mean, being 100% all in to your dream and your business doesn't mean that you're still, you know, not going to have to take a step aside every once in a while and earn a paycheck. We all have rent. We all have mortgages. We all have, you know, food we need to put on the table. So do what you have to do. And you know, again, there's, you know, don't be ashamed of it.
Keep your head held high.
Exactly. One of my friends, he's been a guest on my podcast many times, is Larry Wingate. He's known as the pit bull of, what is it, personal success? I can't ever remember, and I know him well. But and I'm telling you, Larry Wingate, he's one of these guys, he will just tell you which way the corn grows. He's written 6 New York Times bestsellers. I mean, he has had a heck of a role along the way. There was a point where he went from being a millionaire to mowing his neighbor's lawns the next day. You know, he was part of that whole AT&T breakup, the telecommunications breakup, and his business just went down, I mean, almost immediately. And his attitude was, he had a wife and two sons at the time. He needed to take care of them and feed them, and he went out and he talked to his neighbors and said, do you need any help? What can I do? He had no shame in doing that, and I've always held him up as a really responsible role model.
That's a wonderful story, and I think it's that kind of thing that's inspirational, right? I mean, we have all been, I think, trained in our careers of what success looks like. And it's that next step, that next promotion, that it always has to come with a bigger paycheck, and it always has to come with a bigger title and more people under you and a bigger responsibility. And you know what? That's not always the case. And I think we have to rethink success a little bit and think about what makes you happy and think about, again, that balance and not feel like, I think we all feel sometimes like, all the neighbors are looking at us and saying, well, you used to have this job and what happened? It's like, you know what? I'm happy right now and I'm building something. So, you know, hang on. You cannot wait to see what comes next.
Exactly. It's Larry Wingate, pit bull. He calls himself the pit bull of personal development. And I always get hung up on pit bull because he kind of is. So anyway, he's got this terrific story. And I'm telling you, when he told me that story during the first podcast, I went, oh. Yeah, because we all want to kind of put up that facade, like, I'm okay, everything's fine. You know, I'm not about to lose my car or my house, everything's good. It's not. So, you know, get out there and do what you need to do. So that is terrific advice. Listen, you guys have said a couple of times that, you know, from the boardroom to the hallways, do you have any stories that you can tell that are not going to give us a hint of who these companies were? Because I know you've got some terrific stories.
Yeah, I think we definitely have some stories, and we can be broad enough to protect both the innocent and the guilty. You know, we did work for a company once in which they hired a very high-profile executive to come in and lead the transformation of the company, and he was a rather arrogant individual who. Made a point of playing mind games with people and really kind of trying to demonstrate his superior knowledge. And he was brought in to shake things up, but he really, underneath it all, was not a good human being beyond just his performance at work. And within a couple of months, he had to be let go because he had been making advances on a colleague's underage daughter, and it was really... It really affected the culture of the company that they would even bring in someone with this type of background, and it made the senior leadership of the company really question uh, what what were the trade-offs they were willing to make in terms of importing talent versus protecting the culture of good people that they had had there.
So what was the outcome? That's not really my question. Let me back up. How did they not know this about him?
I'm not sure.
Or did they know it?
I think with the reason that it really caused a cultural uproar is that it was clear he was not a good guy. It was not clear he had, a criminal type of background. And again, I'm not sure that it reached the point of criminal behavior, but it was certainly very creepy behavior. And I think the challenge that we had internally in terms of the senior executive team and the board of directors and those of us on the communications team that really tried to articulate what had happened here is that it was well known he was not a pleasant person to be around. It was not known the extent of his creepiness. And that made the senior executive team really have to question, what are we willing to do to import talent? What are we willing to put up with? How much does being a good person matter in addition to being a talented executive?
I think being a good person is a bigger part of it myself. I mean, doesn't that drive everything you do?
I couldn't agree with you more. But I think that there are companies, unfortunately, who are willing to make that trade-off.
And as a person who had to work on, spinning that story and really trying to make sense of it for employees, absolutely, I would agree with you, Denise, that you can be a really talented leader who holds people accountable and delivers business results and be a good person on top of it. And it just takes more work to find and develop those people, but they're out there, and that's who we should all strive to be.
Absolutely. So what was the outcome? I mean, I'm guessing it didn't really hit the news wires, but how long did it take for the company culture to kind of say, okay, we trust you again? Or did that ever come back?
So the outcome, it was that the executive got a huge severance package, and that was part of what really bothered people, is that he was known by then to not be a good guy, and he got a huge severance package to leave anyway. There was some media coverage of it, not the specific actions toward the colleague's daughter, but then the newspapers got a hold of it and dug into it and found some stuff in his background that the company should have known about. And then I think culturally it took a while. It probably took a few months. And when he was replaced with an internal candidate who was a good person, that sent a strong signal to the employees that the company had learned its lesson and was going to value, the quality of the individual as much as the quality of the work output.
That's good. Yeah, emotional intelligence to me is sometimes almost more important than your degree or, whatever else you're bringing to the table. If you're not able to look at the people around you and really connect with them and try to understand what's going on with them and be of assistance to them, I'm not sure what you're doing there.
No,
again,
this is
why I work
you.
Alone. I know who I am.
That's funny. And, we have lots of stories about executives and bad behaviors. We also have worked with amazing senior leaders who are wonderful at what they do and incredibly emotionally intelligent and the kind of leader you would follow anywhere. But as we always say, it's just so much more fun to write about the bad ones. So our books tend to have some pretty bad leadership behaviors and some pretty, shall we say, morally ambiguous leaders because they're just more fun to write about.
Oh, I can imagine. And they're probably easier for people to identify because no matter if we're working in a dry cleaner or we're working in a boardroom, we're going to come across both of these types of people. You can't avoid it. I mean, you're going to hit them in the grocery store. They're everywhere. There's really good people who make an impact, even if you're just chatting with them, across the frozen food aisle, or there's going to be people who are malignant personalities, and if you're smart, you're going to recognize them and walk away. We're not always smart, though, are we?
No, we're not always smart, and sometimes, again, that paycheck, that title, becomes more important than the health of ourselves and our organization. And sometimes we don't always look past the bad ones. We can look past the bad ones to say, yeah, but I'm making a really good paycheck here. But again, it's at what price?
Exactly. Like, you know, Mike said, you go home and, you know, you're kind of taking it out unconsciously probably, but taking it out on your family. I was certainly taking it out on my former husband. When I tell you, I would hit that door and my mouth was going, and I'm not really a big talker. That should have given me some clues that I was really miserable. I mean, just, and to top it off, I would be on the phone in my car with one of my coworkers and we would be complaining. It was very toxic. Very, very toxic. When I left that job, that position, I skipped all the way down the stairs. I skipped across the parking lot. I jumped into my car and I sat there and grinned like an idiot. And that was my last formal job. And I was still the happiest day of my life. Isn't that pathetic?
You know, you just brought up a point, though, that I think is a good one about, you know, complaining at home, but also complaining to your coworkers. You know, it's a theme that runs through our books as well, is about, you know, finding your team, finding your tribe, finding your people at work who not only you can commiserate with, but also the people who have your backs in those tough situations. When you are working for the bad leader, you need those coworkers who understand what you're going through. You know, that's why happy hours are a really big theme in our book. You know, there is something about those interpersonal connections that you make with colleagues that are really they're really lifesavers in so many ways.
Oh, no kidding. Two of the gals that I worked with, we're still good friends. I mean, we bonded in our absolute hatred of our boss. We hated him. We literally could not stand him. We would, you know, we would have little pity parties where we would try to figure out ways to disappear him. And I still kind of shudder when I think about the guy. I mean, murder and mayhem was on our minds and hearts all the time. And you don't want to live like that. I mean, this was years ago now. I mean, many years ago. And I drove past that office not too long ago, and I just involuntarily shuddered. It's like, ugh. And he's probably still doing exactly what he did then. And he wasn't a bad guy. He was just a miserable, wretched little guy. That should have been my first tip. But, you know, I mean, he was just, he had all the bad attributes that are, you know, assigned to small men, unfortunately. It's almost like he just took them and wrapped them around him. But just not a pleasant fellow. And I'm telling you, this was when I drove by there and I just went, oh my God, I just passed what we call at the Deep South, a whole body freeze on. The hair on my arms rose up. Not a good thing. So I would love, before I start rambling, for you guys to share some of the great stories in the book that I know you've got favorite passages in this book. You have to, because you're practically, you birthed this thing. It's your baby. What are some of the favorite things in this book that you can share with the audience?
Sure. So in Operation Cluster Puck, you know, there are some, yes, it's been called an LOL delight. It's been called, a laugh out loud page turner of a novel. And we of course appreciate those reviews, but it's also heartfelt. I mean, you know, again, there are these wonderful moments in the book that are very, very personal to us. And in Operation Cluster Puck, this is very much ripped from real life, where the character of Anna, as she is figuring out her purpose and her legacy and how to balance her professional and her personal life, she has some unfinished business with her father. And there's a moment in the book where she is talking to Will, her colleague, and she is saying that she's going to put off this thing that she has to do regarding her father because work is just so busy right now and there's too many things going on and they need her there. And there's a pause where, again, very, very much real life, where Will says to her, "You have to get off the hamster wheel. You have to think about your work in a different way. Your dad will always be your dad. And if you let the company make decisions for you. The company will always choose itself. That's what companies are designed to do. And he takes her from a moment of, I am just on this hamster wheel and I have to do what the company needs me to do, to really taking that step back and saying, the company will live without me. It's fine. I need to go do this because it's my family. And that's a really personal thing for me. And it's a personal moment in the book that is a pretty, I mean, let's be clear, it's a pretty raucous book. It's, you know, it's edgy. There's funny things. There's some big, crazy things that happen. But I love that moment because it's so personal and it's so real.
And this is a real-life conversation, wasn't it?
It was a real-life conversation. And, you know, I'm sure it's not unlike conversations that a lot of people have had with very good colleagues somewhere throughout their careers that make you take a step back and really realize what you've been doing and what you want.
Now, I have to ask, when this conversation took place, did Anna immediately go, oh, yeah, you're right, or was it something that for many of us you have to go, yeah, okay, and you just kind of brush it off, but at 3 o'clock in the morning when your subconscious wakes you up and says, hello, did you actually listen to that? What are you going to do about it? How did that kind of play out for you or for Anna?
You know,
let's pretend it's
Anna.
Yeah,
and I think, right, I think it's both. You know, for me and for the character of Anna, you know, in the moment you say, oh, you know, you're right. Like, just text me later about what happens in the company and I'll still be, you know, on email and I'll still be tuned in. But later you reflect back and really recognize that as an inflection point. You recognize that as a point in your career and in your life where you can point to that conversation and say, that was exactly right, and that was the moment I started to make some different choices.
Excellent. So, Mike, how about you? What great stories do you – what is one of your favorite moments or chapters or tip in the book?
So I would actually go back to the first book, BS Incorporated, because that's where Will sort of has his pivotal moment. And Will, as we said earlier, is one of those guys who just rolls along with everything and does what the company asks him to do. He started out working in the warehouse. And again, that's very much drawn from my personal life. I worked in a warehouse environment while I was going to school. So we embedded Will with that background, and his mentor was his warehouse boss, whose name was Big Al. And Will eventually gets a job in the corporate tower and becomes an advisor to the CEOs, again, very much ripped from my story as well. And when the company is careening out of control in the first book, Will feels very powerless about what to do to stop it. And he goes out for a beer with Big Al, and Big Al tells him that he has the connections and the intelligence, and he's the one who can actually build that bridge between the warehouse crews and the C-suite. And Will doesn't want to hear it. He's not a guy who seeks the spotlight. He's not a guy who takes risks. And his unemotional mentor tells him that he doesn't have a choice. You don't have a choice, Will. You have to do this. We're all counting on you. And so that was. And again, to your point, he doesn't have a magical transformation in that moment. He begins with one timid step after another, and he seeks Anna's help, and together they take a couple timid steps forward. And I don't want to give away the end, but to me that was that's my favorite story, because again, there's pieces of it drawn from my real life, and I think it's the kind of message so often we need to hear, is that we are in control of our own destiny, we do hold more power than we give ourselves credit for, and that we can make a difference.
And I Denise, I have to jump in here, because as Mike said, his background in real life was working in the warehouse, and we had created this fictional character named Big Al. Well, Big Al was a real person. And I didn't know that for a while. So Mike had really invented this character of Big Al, and we wrote for him, and he's wonderful, and he's the kind of leader everybody wants to work for. And at one of our first book events for our first book, BS Incorporated, I got to meet the real Big Al, and it was like meeting a celebrity. It's like, you're a real person. Like, I've written things that you have said, and like, you are a real guy. It was a really surreal moment.
Did Big Al know he was in the book?
He didn't at first. We had lost touch. Then we did a book signing event at a bookstore in my hometown, and through friends of friends, I managed to make contact with him again, and he showed up at the event. So it was really fun. It was one of those really gratifying moments of, you know, pursuing the dream and having written the book, and then being able to go back to people like Big Al and you know, talk to them about what a difference they made in my life.
I love that story. I mean, I can only imagine how that made him feel, because, you know, we do. We go about our daily business, and we often, too often, don't really understand how we impact others. So you had an opportunity to show him just how impactful he was. That's wonderful.
Yeah, it really was, and it's a great point. I'm glad you drew that out, Denise, because I think we too often don't go back and tell those people who've made a difference that they've done so. And you know, we're just so busy plugging along, and we take the advice, and we might look back and say, oh, that was good advice, but you know, we have the ability to make a difference in each other's lives, and we really owe it to anybody who's done that for us to let them know what an impact they've made.
Absolutely. And that's part of what y'all talk about, you know, being authentic and being true to who you are and to the, you know, the impact that you have on the people around you. Would you guys like to expand on that just a bit? We've got about 3 more minutes, so we've got a little bit of time if you have more to share.
Yeah, I'll just quickly say that you do have to be true to who you are, and that is definitely a theme in our books, and that holds true about staying true to who you are as a person and as a company. And I think sometimes in business we lose sight of both of those things. So, you know, a really good tip that I have for people is to find out who you are, figure that out, take a personality inventory, do Myers-Briggs, learn to play to your strengths. And that's something that we coach our communications executives as well, you know, when they're trying to improve their communication with their business. Whether you're a CEO or a business owner or a middle manager, figure out what your strengths are and then play to them. And if you're a business leader, figure out who your company is. Figure out the culture. Figure out what sets your company apart. Go talk to your frontline employees. Talk to your customers in depth and figure out what that story is. And then, you know, that's your core. That's your authenticity. When you communicate, have it be from a place of strength. Have it be from a place of authenticity. And you really can't go wrong.
I agree. Mike?
You know, I would just echo on to what Jennifer said. And I've been fortunate to work for some senior leaders and even some small business owners that are really, really clear about who they are as individuals and what they're trying to accomplish with their business. And I've taken a lot away from that. And it's easy when you have success to start to, you know, read your own press clippings. And the best business leaders that I've worked with, and again, the size of the organization doesn't matter, are those people who really stay true to who they are, whether they're failing or whether they are succeeding. They're the same person. They treat you the same way. And they have a way about them that says, you know, you're going to get the same Mike or Jennifer or John or Lisa or whoever it is. I'm going to be the same person, whether I'm succeeding or struggling.
Exactly. You know what it took me the longest kind of time to figure out what my best skills were my soft skills. I mean, I'm a nerd. I have a computer science degree. I build websites when I'm, you know, I architect them in my head. When I'm washing the dishes, I'm always thinking. But I found, and it took me the longest kind of time, I'm embarrassed to say how long it took me to figure out that my soft skills are really the ones that hold me to my purpose, if you will. And I'm not sure if that even makes sense, but it took the longest kind of time. It's not what I know or how I do it. It's really who I am. And that was a big eye-opener, and I think that's what y'all are talking about here.
That's exactly right, Denise. And again, you know, sometimes it takes somebody outside of you, whether it's a therapist or a life coach or a personality inventory, to point those things out to you and to highlight your strengths. I think it's often very tough for us as individuals to figure out what we're great at. We need somebody else to point that out to us.
Exactly. Well, listen, we are just about out of time. So, Jennifer, Mike, where can people find you on the web? Where can they find your company? Where can they find your books?
So you can find Operation Clusterpuck and BS Incorporated on Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, or direct from our distributor at rockandvossbooks.com. And you can get to our business through that Rock and Voss Books website as well.
Yeah, I have those. The links are in the show notes, but not everybody is going to read the show notes, so it's important that people can find you. Listen, thank you both. This has been such a pleasure speaking with you, and I really thank you for all the wonderful tips and advice that you've shared with our audience, and I hope the audience will go find both books. But seriously, grab Operation Clusterpuck. It's hilarious and thought-provoking, and it's one of those books that you're going to sit down, and about, you know, a year later, you're going to go, oh, where did I read that? Oh, yeah. It really is going to get your mind kind of working towards how to be the best you. So before we say goodbye, I would like to remind our audience to be sure to look for us in iTunes and anywhere else you consume your business podcasts. Just look for Your Partner in Success Radio and take us along on your success journey. Thank you both so much.
Thank you for having us, Denise.
Get your voice heard. If you would like to launch your own far-reaching podcast, contact Denise Griffiths at yourofficeontheweb.com and go to the podcast tab.